AFEO Now is presented by Northwest Financial Advisors, where our world revolves around you.
Hello, everyone. This is Jim Hughes with AFEO Now. We are a program of recorded interviews with former senior U.S. intelligence officers. And today I have a really amazing guest. His name is Chip Beck. He is a retired Navy commander, a career CIA clandestine services officer, and a former State Department foreign affairs officer. Between 1969 and 2013, he participated in and witnessed dozens of wars, revolutions, and civil conflicts. In the late 60s and up to the mid 70s, he served in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. And he has a brand new book out entitled Final Days of Heroes. Chip, welcome to AFEO Now.
Thank you very much for having me.
Chip, explain to our audience a little bit about the upcountry program in Cambodia.
Well, the upcountry program in Cambodia was kind of an add-on to the Indochina wars when Vietnam and Laos were downsizing the presence of American troops and advisors. And Dr. Henry Kissinger wanted to know what was going on in Cambodia because we didn't have much of an eyes-on presence up in the countryside. So in late 73, headquarters was tasked with sending about 12 to 14 clandestine service paramilitary officers up into the countryside to see what was going on and just advise Washington of what was happening as the rest of Indochina was sliding down the path to oblivion, I guess. But we had some operational tasks which were impossible to achieve, like trying to recruit a high-level Khmer Rouge informant, which never happened. But the rest of the time, we just kind of let Phnom Penh Station and Washington know just what was going on in the field with the North Vietnamese and the Khmer Rouge.
So as part of this program, you were assigned to a town called Kampong Thom. What was the significance of that town?
Well, Kampong Thom is on the eastern side of the Great Lake called Tonle Sap Lake. And it was a crossroads historically under the French and during the Indochina War. And it allowed, during our time in 74, 75, the North Vietnamese and the Khmer Rouge to sweep down from the border areas of Laos and Vietnam towards Phnom Penh, which was the main target. And so if the enemy forces could capture Kampong Thom, which at one point they had, it would allow them unfettered access for their logistical systems to use the pathways and roads and waterways down to Phnom Penh. So we were almost blocking mechanism for to prevent the wholesale access of the enemy forces towards Phnom Penh.
Chip, describe for our audience the principal heroes in your book.
Well, the principal heroes in the book, the two or three main ones, Colonel Ki Hak, the commander of the 11th Brigade, who later became General Ki Hak. Then there is General Thiep Ben, who was the 10th Brigade commander and also the Governor General of Kampong Thom. And then the third hero is my counterpart and assistant, Lieutenant Chung Tep, who was an intelligence officer assigned to me in Kampong Thom. And the three of them really did some incredible things, which I relate in the book, Final Days of Heroes. And besides that, just the men and women and soldiers of Kampong Thom itself, which numbered, in the dozens of military heroes, they were just an incredibly brave group of people. And I was more or less honored to live among them for 15 and witness and participate, in what they did. And so they were all heroes in my estimation, but the three main ones were Ki Hak, Thiep Ben, and Chung Tep, but not to diminish the others either.
Describe the Kampong Thom breakout raid and then later the rice raid.
Yeah, I was originally signed to Siem Reap, which is up where Angkor Wat and Angkor Thom are, the old tourist locations where they even filmed Lord Jim with Peter O'Toole back in the early 60s. But when I got to Siem Reap, there wasn't anything going on up there. That had been nearly attacked early in the 1970 period and Chip Ben and Kee Hock had thwarted the enemy assault on that, and then moved down to Kompong Tom, which had actually been captured by the Khmer Rouge. And in late 73, Chip Ben and Kee Hock recaptured Kompong Tom after house to house for about 1 to 2 months. And then in early January 74, I arrived down there and saw that this was an incredible group of people. And they had retaken the city and pushed the Khmer Rouge out into the countryside about a mile away or so. And then in late January of 74, Colonel Kee Hock decided that he was going to go even farther out into the countryside and just upset the Khmer Rouge. And I hadn't been there very long. And basically one night, Kee Hock took the entire 11th Brigade and walked out in the middle of darkness up along National Route 6 into the countryside. And by dawn the next morning, he was well inside Khmer Rouge territory, just confounding the enemy that with his presence. And he was bringing back civilians from the countryside. He got up on chairs and stumps and stuff and told them, look, you know, you've lived out here for 4 years under the communists. You know what it's like. There's corruption in the government, but we're here to help you and save you and take you back. And he brought back, just in that 1 3-day period, 10,000 refugees in ox carts and all their belongings. They just wanted to escape from communism. And I was invited, so to speak, by Kee Hock to come out and actually witness it. And what was going on is the most remarkable movement of human beings I'd ever seen, even in Laos and in Vietnam. And we had quite a few adventures during the brief time that I was out there, including a gunfight with a Khmer Rouge battalion commander and me. And in the space of the next month, based on that first operation, Kee Hock and the 11th Brigade brought back 45,000 people into Kompong Tom, which originally only had 15,000. So within a couple months, we had 60,000 people there, and Chep Ben and Kee Hock, true to their promise, helped establish refugee towns and cities around Kompong Tom. And so it was a complete slap in the face of the Khmer Rouge. But unfortunately, USAID and other U.S. government enterprises couldn't supply food and sustenance to the new 45,000 refugees. So Kee Hock decided he would go out and capture more supplies from the main Khmer Rouge depot that his informants told him were out about 20 miles in the countryside. And they went out, and I went out with them. And we engaged in the enemy on the way out. And then at one point the next day, I walked back to Kompong Tom on my own. And we got 2,000 ox carts to go out and captured over 1,000 tons of rice and supplies by which the new refugees were able to sustain themselves for the next year, basically.
That's an amazing story. What was the overall impact of those raids on the battlefield?
Well, the overall impact was to really tick off the enemy, and to the point where they diverted about a regiment of crack Khmer Rouge troops from Phnom Penh to join the regiment or so that had already been encircling Kompong Tom. So for the next several months, we had a bunch of angry enemy soldiers trying to surround Kompong Tom and attack us. And it came down basically to the last line of defense about half a mile beyond Kompong Tom. And had they broken through, the city probably would have either fallen or we would have had house-to-house fighting again. But what it did, in a way, it probably changed the North Vietnamese and Khmer Rouge timetable for capturing Phnom Penh. They had expected to do it in 1974, but they weren't able to do it until 1975. And I think part of the reason, not all the reason, but part of the reason was they had to divert some of their best troops to try and attack us up in Kompong Tom. And of course, the amazing part was the defenders of Kompong Tom, behaving almost like the Alamo, didn't go down in defeat. In fact, they rose up in victory.
What did Kee Hock and Thiep Ben do to prepare Kompong Tom for the siege? And what was the final outcome?
Well, they built some natural and unnatural defenses in a way. With all the refugees in there, they needed to make some rice paddies and stuff, and they flooded some areas for the rice paddies using the Stung Sen River. And what that did was flood a lot of areas that would prevent the enemy from easily accessing from the north. And they were trying to flood the area to the south of us, but the rains didn't come in time to assist. But they had built a huge berm along the southern perimeter of Kompong Tong. It was probably over 2 miles long. And it became kind of a dirt defensive force, almost like the ramparts that were used in the American Civil War. They had all the troops stationed where they needed to be. The 10th Brigade was lined up against the south, the 11th Brigade in the north. And then thousands and thousands of refugees also helped build the defenses at the same time that they were building their own refugee villages and stuff. So we knew they were coming, and you know, we just tried to prepare the defenses both physically and mentally as best we could. And then the enemy attacked.
And what was the outcome?
We won. It got down to the point, the last outpost at Rulos, which I describe in the book, resulted in hand-to-hand combat. And I was there on the last day when victory was finally achieved. And it was an incredible experience being there in this little tiny outpost with soldiers stabbing each other with bayonets and throwing grenades from hole to hole. And at the outcome, over the probably the last 2 weeks, there was like 3,000 enemy dead. And Chip Ben's forces and Kehok only lost about 15. And it totally defeated the Khmer Rouge thrust. And it was remarkable because at the end of that battle, there were just hundreds of enemy laying in the battlefield around us. And the newspapers in the States, the LA Times, the Washington Post, had announced that some rockets had fallen in Phnom Penh and three people were killed. And they totally missed the fact that, you know, 3,000 enemy soldiers were killed up country. And they missed the whole story. But after that, the Khmer Rouge went back into the bush. After that defeat, the Khmer Rouge pulled back and licked their wounds and didn't bother us for the rest of the dry season.
Describe the situation in Phnom Penh in the summer of 1974. And what was Operation 802?
Operation 802 was kind of an extension of what had happened around Kompong Tom. And the Cambodian military, which is called FANC, their high command, asked Kehok to open up the road between Kompong Tom and Siem Reap, which was Operation 802. So he went back with a couple of his battalions and cleared the road between those two cities so that convoys and escorted vehicular movements could take place. So open up another channel between the two provincial capitals. And he was successful in doing that to the point where he was subsequently called back down to Phnom Penh to become a 7th Division commander as a colonel. And they set up the defenses to the northwest of the capital, Phnom Penh.
But how effective was the FANG defensive to Phnom Penh in the kind of summer and fall of 1974?
It was hanging on, but that's all it was doing. And the morale was low. One of the problems was that the division commanders around Phnom Penh, most of those were, I hate to say it, but not professional. Some of them were corrupt. They would sit back in their villas and houses in Phnom Penh and let their subordinates take on the brunt of the fighting and around the capital. Kehok, of course, was totally the opposite. He was always at the forefront with his men. He had been wounded 6 times in the course of the war, and he just never would let his men go anywhere that he wasn't already out in front of them. So he was one of the few that went out. The morale was really, really low around Phnom Penh. So I think they sensed the end was coming, and they tried their best, and they fought bravely. And out in the hinterlands of the provincial capitals, where you had leaders and soldiers who had worked together and fought together against the Khmer Rouge as a team or teams, in the end, they held on even after Phnom Penh fell and were fighting basically to the death.
What preparations did you make in order to evacuate Allied fighters and their family members?
Well, you know, living up country, I witnessed the killing fields even before it became well known back in the States. I mean, I came across scores of people had been basically butchered and hacked and beaten. And I heard through our translators, of course, the threats that the Radio Sihanouk, which was really a Khmer Rouge operation, threatening any and all Cambodians who had anything whatsoever to do with the Law and No regime, the Americans, Western humanitarian outfits, anything like that, they're all going to be put to the death. They were all marked for execution. So I knew that our assets, our intelligence assets, as well as just our support people were in danger. So I worked with Keehawk and Tiep Ben to set up an idea that I then cleared with the station, and they cleared it with Washington, to set up an escape route up in northern Cambodia in the province of Samrong, which could lead into southern Thailand, or not southern Thailand, the southern part of eastern Thailand, to a place called Surin. And so over the course of a month, using our air assets and so forth, I moved both a cadre of our intelligence assets as well as their families up to this place and scattered out 50 miles of mountainous jungles that used to be used by the Khmer Sarai fighters against the French, and established an escape route into Thailand, and had that all set up with a plan that not if Phnom Penh fell, but when it fell, that they could use that route to escape to safety. And among those that set up were Chung Tep's wife and mother and six children, because I promised him if he went on what was basically a secret mission to set up a resistance in Cambodia after the fall of Phnom Penh, that if he did this, I would make sure that his family, you know, got out of the country safely and were taken care of. And that, in fact, happened.
Describe the final days of the Phnom Penh government, the U.S. Embassy evacuation, and Project X-Ray.
Well, the upcountry advisors have been told sometime, I think, maybe late March, that, hey, we're going to leave Cambodia. There's going to be an evacuation. There's no question about it. They didn't have a timetable or a date, so we didn't know when we were going to leave. But we knew it was going to happen. So I was setting up this escape route up in northern Cambodia, expecting that we probably had a couple more weeks to go. And fortunately, things were all in place for the escape mechanism. But one day, what would that be, April 5th or something like that, we get a radio call from Phnom Penh, encrypted, of course, and saying, basically, guys, we're evacuating all of you tomorrow. The embassy's, you know, going to ships at sea, and you're going to Saigon. We'll send an old C-47 up to pick you up and take you and your folks over to Thonsonut Air Force Base. And so I didn't have time to go back to Phnom Penh and try and get Keehawk's wife and family out. And that was part of the plan for Keehawk in his efforts to set up a resistance. I was to get his family out so he could operate on his own. I couldn't get there, so I asked somebody from the station to go over and tell Mrs. Keehawk to get on the plane the next day. And they did, and she didn't quite understand what she was supposed to do, so she didn't do it. She didn't show up for the evacuation plane at the embassy the next day. And that changed the whole dynamics of how Keehawk and Chung Tep were to be able to escape the encirclement of Phnom Penh, because Keehawk had to take his family out in a jeep rather than walk on foot. And that became a disaster that I describe in the book. But by then, the front was falling apart all across the north and west of Phnom Penh, and the Khmer Rouge were coming up the rivers from South Vietnam and basically encircled Phnom Penh, almost like, you know, the Alamo had been encircled and broke through, and basically put everybody to the sword, the officers, the enlisted, families. Thousands of people were murdered that day.
How much advance notice did senior members of the Phnom Penh government have? And did they accept the offer for evacuation?
No, they didn't have much warning at all. In fact, some of us up country told our counterpart, well, not to tell our counterparts that the U.S. was going to leave. And we didn't know when that was going to happen, so we couldn't tell them when. But we basically, to a man, told our counterparts, hey, we're going to leave. You better make your plans to do whatever you need to do without us. That didn't happen in Phnom Penh. The highest leaders of the government were only informed the day of the evacuation that the evacuation was going to take place. Sao Kham Koi, who was the interim president, did accept to get on the planes, but the other high-level guys like Prime Minister, I'm having a senior moment here, Lon Barret and Lon Nan, the brother of Lon Nol, and Suri Matak, another high-level guy, they just refused to get on the planes. They said, no, we're not leaving. And they died, a few days later when the Khmer Rouge broke through, but they refused to leave, but they didn't have much warning. In fact, there were a lot of empty seats on the evacuation planes. Unlike Saigon, Ambassador John Gunther Dean had been quietly sending non-essential personnel out on airplanes for 2 months ahead of time, just telling them, hey, guys, you're going on vacation, but you're never coming back, the wives and the logisticians and others. So we didn't really have that many people to evacuate in terms of American personnel when the actual Operation Eagle Pull took place. And as you probably recall, the evacuation in Saigon was a three-ring circus. Yeah.
And what was the final fate of General Ki Hoc and his family and Lieutenant Chun Tep and his family?
Well, according to what I found out later, I had the term we used then was a houseboy. It was a retired Army colonel that worked with me up in Phnom Penh, kept the residence that I was in shape and everything like that. And he was part of the evacuation to Surin, but he was very devoted to Chung Tep and Chung Tep's family and to Ki Hoc. So rather than going into the refugee channels, he went back into Cambodia for several months and eventually met up with some of the 11th Brigade survivors. Then he himself got out again and wound up writing me a letter telling me what these people had seen. Now, it's not 100% substantiated, but I do have the letter that he had transcribed to me in French, which told how Ki Hoc had taken his wife and four children and tried to escape in a jeep going out the last road through Prochintan Airport towards the southern coast where he'd grown up as a boy. And the noose tightened before he could get out. And the Khmer Rouge apprehended him and his family and walked over to a Buddhist temple and basically killed the children in front of the parents, then killed the wife in front of Ki Hoc and eventually killed him. And according to what I had been told, Chung Tep, who had discarded his uniform and his covert communications, was watching this, and he was trying to blend into the civilian exodus, and he was never heard from again. So it took about 7 years, and Chung Tep was declared legally dead or deceased, so his family could move on. And the family, by the way, is all here in the United States and have maintained contact with them all these years.
Well, it's an amazing true story. I really couldn't put the book down. The descriptions are very, very vivid, and I recommend it to anyone in our audience. I want to thank Chip Beck for taking some time with us today to describe to us the events that he experienced in Cambodia back in the middle 1970s.
Thank you for having me, Jim. I appreciate it very much.
AFIO is a small, nonprofit, apolitical, educational organization whose main mission is to help prepare the next generation of intelligence officers to confront the challenges our nation faces in the years ahead. To learn more or support our outreach programs, visit www.afio.com.